Hello, and welcome to Natural Geekery. This is a podcast focusing on gaming, storytelling, and creativity, how it comes to be, how it shapes us, how it molds us, and how it intertwines and creates an amazing community. This is episode 11. I'm Brian. Welcome aboard. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast, and welcome to part two of my interview with Michael Underwood, speculative fictionero. He's a published author of speculative fiction and a champion of equal rights and diversity. He's just an all-around great guy. I'm not going to say much on this. Apologize for my voice. I am going through a bit of a cold, but that won't stop the podcast. And so here we go. I'm going to jump right into this second part of the interview with Michael Underwood, and then I will see you on the other side. Thanks for being here. And let's talk to Mr. Underwood. Shifting gears just a bit from that, more talking about the publication industry right now, and having worked in it for as long as you did, and then now you are a self-publishing author, where do you see things heading with publishing in the great, crazy Wild West that is Amazon and self-publishing?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to tackle this. So I think one that I'd start with is there's a growing set of data across a number of studies that's suggesting that a lot of authors are more likely to be more financially successful if they pursue a hybrid style career. That is, publication, some with larger or other traditional publishing houses. So your Big Fives, your Penguin Random Houses, your Macmillan's, Hachette, and so on, as well as self-publishing. There are a lot of self-published authors who make gigantic amounts of money. There are traditional authors who make gigantic amounts of money. But based on the data we have so far, which is still very meager, because self-publishing in fiction as a really a going concern is at most a decade old. The Kindle, I think, releases in 2008 or 2009. So we're 10 years from the beginning of Kindle. And the Kindle Gold Rush was really more 2010, 2011, 2012, depending on which era you're talking about. So all of this is still really new.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's one thing. Another thing is that from my experience, if you want to be a self-published author, you are signing up to be an entrepreneur. And sure. Probably if you think this is something you want to do, it's probably because you like control. You want to be able to have your fingers dipping in a bunch of different pots. You want that self-determination. You want to be able to really set yourself challenges, and you want to do the work more than you want to try to get something out of a relationship with publishers. And because I've done both of these things and I've been on the publisher side, I don't think one of them is automatically better than the other. Because if you're a self-publisher, you are a publisher. You are hiring editors. You are hiring artists. You are hiring designers. You're hiring formatting people. You are entering into contractual relationships with printers and distributors and all of this stuff. It just feels very different because being a publisher is different than being an author.
Right.
Or being a publisher is very different from just being a writer. And when people are like A versus B, for me, self-publishing and traditional publishing, they're different paths, but they're very drastically different models. And I'm seeing the traditional book sales ecosystem and the self-publishing sales ecosystem in English diverging more and more. The types of sales strategies that people are using in ebook, especially for Kindle Unlimited, it's more longer series, shorter books, super rapid release, strong emphasis on pay per click advertising on Amazon and Facebook, maybe also BookBub, and that world moves very, very fast. The traditional world, in some ways, has slowed down in response. They're trying to get more out of any given book. They're publishing fewer series or more duologies than trilogies. They're maybe less likely to start new long series. And I'm mostly speaking in science fiction, fantasy, adult fiction, because that's the territory I know the most. Your individual experience may vary, dear listener. So I try to not universalize too much. So in traditional, you're more going to see a standalone book where the publisher is really trying to get every bit of attention and interest and sales in that one book versus a self-published author who's like, okay, cool. I wrote 300,000 words this year and I'm going to release them as 4 books over the course of 5 months. And here's my sales strategy. And I'm going to put 80% of my sales from the first book into cost per click advertisements and list builders so that I'm going to bring people into the series so that the sell through on the series increases and I'm going to make all my profit off of that. It's almost a whole different language.
Wow. Wow.
I'm a traditional author. I try to build a good relationship with an agent who then gets me a strong publishing deal from a publisher who is going to invest in a big way in my book. And I'm going to coordinate with my publisher so that my promotional activities and their promotional activities are really in sync. And whatever they're doing that I'm really not privy to lines up with what I'm doing, and that we have a shared vision for what this book is. And we're being really thoughtful about how we can communicate in a way that helps the book reach its ideal reader. And then the publisher does all of their things.
Right.
So that's one, that's a really big trend. Another part that you alluded to that I will try to speak in brief, at least to start, is that Amazon has, in my opinion, already gone far beyond what should be legally actionable anti-competitive behavior and has gotten away with it because they're very large and because most of the traditional publishing ecosystem is too afraid or too bound by like sharekeeper, shareholder fear. To actually do something about Amazon. They've gotten too big. They have committed a number of fairly heinous abuses against individual self-published authors. They're pulling people into a walled ecosystem. They are driving down prices through devaluing books by aggressively discounting physical so that people are more likely to buy the ebook and that the overall price valuation of books goes down so that Amazon, with their proportional advantage on kind of wholesale economics because of the big discount that they get from publishers, they're able to just gobble up a larger and larger part of the world. Right. And Amazon sells books in their own way. They don't share their data unless they're absolutely forced to do so. And because they're a big black box, they sell books. They use that customer data from people reading on Kindle to sell more books, to sell more books. And the more of your reading and media consumption life happens in Amazon, Kindle Unlimited, buying retail online, using Amazon Prime for audio or for TV, the more they have data about your entire life. And they're also very happy to sell that data to advertisers. They are a cyberpunk style mega corporation and publishing. Sure. Not currently know how to stop them. And the US antitrust laws are very weak and were defined decades ago and are fairly ineffective at addressing the problems that Amazon has created because Amazon puts customer value first. Low prices can't be antitrust.
Right.
By limited understanding of antitrust law, I'm not a lawyer, but I work in publishing. I've seen a lot of this stuff and that's just how I see the field. So it could be really hard because there is really nobody keeping Amazon in check.
Right. The megacorp and and all of its quote unquote glory.
Yeah. And that's not even to mention their labor practices, which are a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely.
But if you're an author, if you're a self-published author, choosing to not do any business with Amazon is cutting off your body to like, it's cutting off your head to spite your toes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You have no choice. You have to interact with them in some way.
Yeah. Or you have to build your entire career outside of their ecosystem, which is
sure
to do now than maybe 10 years ago or even 5 years ago with something like Patreon or Kickstarter, but it's not just hard mode. It's like extreme Iron Man hard mode.
Okay. Well, thank you for breaking that down. For all you folks out there that want to write, keep writing, join the resistance, keep writing. So switching over to role-playing games now, and this is a question I've started to really love asking people. You may or may not remember the moment, but I like to ask, do you remember the moment in role-playing, what was going on or what the situation was when you hit your aha moment of, holy crap, this is the game or the hobby that I want to do maybe for the rest of my life? Or the moment when it really hits you like a lightning bolt that this is it.
I think one of the side effects of starting with tabletop so early is that I almost certainly had those moments, but I was like 11 and I have no memory of them.
Okay, fair.
what I think I can give you instead is a couple of moments in my teens that probably solidified the hobby as something that I would want to do my whole life. And that would be, it'd be moments like the 7th C RPG first edition that I played with Jack Norris, who's a game designer.
Right.
Works a lot on Green Ronin stuff right now.
Mm-hmm. And so, Mobius. Yeah. Mobidius. Hopefully you're going to have him on the show in a few weeks.
So Jack was running a game with 7th C, and I and my friend were both playing members of the kind of Knights of the Rosen Cross, like the most open secret society, you know, very musketeersy, but not tied to a specific nation. And my character's mentor dies in the first session, very Obi-Wan Kenobi style. So I had this campaign-long revenge plot to pursue. Mm-hmm. So I had a specific narrative reason to justify the kind of mechanical progression of gaining skill and capability, because that was in this character's mind. And the type of role-playing and folding in of character backgrounds and motivations over the course of that game, that was one of the earlier campaigns of kind of my late teens and early 20s that really struck home the full promise of what tabletop role-playing could be in terms of getting to see a whole story to its completion, in having that level of investment in the character and being able to engage some with the mechanics in a way that helped make the story stronger.
Right. Okay. Very cool. You and I, we, in our almost weekly discussions, we talk about gaming theory and different systems. Right now, what systems or system are you jazzed about?
I've really been chewing on the Forged in the Dark school of games. So that's games that are hacks of or inspired by Blades in the Dark by John Harper.
Uh-huh.
And I came across John through some various Let's Plays of like Roll20 Presents Apocalypse World, and was around to back the Blades in the Dark Kickstarter. And so I've gotten to see the development of all of these hacks. And Blades in the Dark, in brief, is a industrial fantasy game about scoundrels in a city of perpetual twilight, where every inch of territory is claimed by somebody. Mm-hmm. So you have to fight, kill, blackmail, or whatever to get every little bit of scrap of territory. And you're playing scoundrels who are kind of trying to rogue their way up the ladder. And its big touchstones are the Dishonored series of games, the Vlad Taltosh books by Stephen Brust, the Thief series of video games, and a couple of other things. And Blades, its whole mechanical and play loop is designed to do a mission and then cool down time. So you have there's mechanics for kind of narrative montage and strong scene-based action, but also mechanization of things kind of on a longer term. And Blades in the Dark is largely inspired by the Power by the Apocalypse style of design from Apocalypse World by Vincent and Maggie Baker. I apologize. I think that's not the pronunciation of Meg's name. But I don't remember what the right one is. But the two of them on Apocalypse World, and there's a whole host of games that come from that are the Power by the Apocalypse style.
Right.
So within those, I'm playing Scum and Villainy, which is a kind of space opera, rogue, Firefly, Cowboy Bebop, Blake Seven, or Star Warsy kind of thing. And I'm also excited about other hacks like Band of Blades, which is more like a Glenn Cook's Black Company kind of a game. And with all of these games, they have these different tools that are designed with a set of expectations and thoughts or ideas about using mechanics for narrative roleplay that operate at a more sophisticated level than the stuff that I played as a teenager and early 20-something, because there were all these years of development of role-playing game theory at places like The Forge and RPGNet and now kind of all over the internet. So it's really fun for me, because I did academic study of tabletop role-playing games in grad school, taking, you know, years and years of play to an academic point, to now be able to engage with systems that are kind of, for me, on the leading edge of what we're able to do with role-playing games.
Right, right. I'm going to jump forward, because you were talking about narrative games. I think this is a good place to put this in. We have talked before about the concept of failing forward, which is something that your traditional, more crunchier games have a hard time doing, though it could be easily implemented once you grok it. Can you discuss what failing forward means and kind of touch on that?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you exactly when that term kind of came into my gaming lexicon. I see it associated with games like Fate Core, but also Power of the Apocalypse type games. And it may even trace back to kind of mid-2000s Forge theory stuff. So I apologize that I don't have a specific citation. But for me, what failing forward is that the story always moves forward, no matter what the dice say.
Okay.
And in a lot of games, like this came up when we were talking about Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, which is my favorite version of D&D by far.
Sure.
I think it has learned a lot of lessons from what other role-playing games are doing. But in D&D 5th Edition, rules as written, I hit the orc with my axe. I miss. What happens in the fiction? You miss, and then the story picks back up again.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
It feels like it is at most a null state result. A failure does not have other mechanical impacts. It does not have other narrative impacts, except in very rare cases.
Yeah, Yeah.
Like a fail forward system like the Powered by the Apocalypse games in Dungeon World, if I roll to hack and slash, which is hit an orc with my axe, and I roll a miss, what that means is that there is a big consequence, or that the GM is going to make a move, capital M, where there is a narrative and or mechanical effect, and the story moves forward. I tried to do a thing, I described what I wanted to have happen, the dice said no, not the way you want it. And then the player in negotiation with the GM usually having the final say since it's a failure, you decide together, how does the fiction change? And that tends to create a more narratively and mechanically engaged flow of play than the null result state of a default D&D attack.
Yeah, you swing and you miss.
Yeah,
but what? Yeah, and the Fate Core does that with you can fail or you can succeed at a minor cost, which is very similar in that. And I love that mechanic. And like I said, you could begin to implement that in a more traditional role playing game setting, but it is a very cool concept that I kind of wanted to introduce more people to, because I think it needs to kind of get out there. Where do you see role playing game or the role-playing game industry heading? I'm curious on your thoughts.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's obviously one of the big things happening in tabletop right now is the streaming revolution. It from games like Critical Role or the streamed games on the D&D official Twitch channel, or something like Acquisitions Incorporated from, you know, various PAX conventions. So the notion of tabletop role-playing game as performance for an outside audience is very different from what I grew up with. And in my thesis, which I wrote from 2005 to 2007, I specifically talked about how one of the things that made role-playing distinct was that it was this performance shared among players who were also audience. and specifically that it was a emergent and ephemeral thing, where it came kind of organically out of play and out of the performance event, because I was using like performance studies kinds of jargon there,
sure.
But also ephemeral. You didn't tend to record the whole session. And then over the time with podcasting and streaming and other things, I think Acquisitions Incorporated deserves a fair bit of credit here for being one of the earlier larger profile games where actual play as performance to be enjoyed as by a consumer became more popular. And there's a lot of other places. And now we see we've got your Critical Roles, but you've also got huge podcasts like Friends at the Table or God's Fall or Critical Role also has a podcast, The McElroys, The Adventure Zone, spinning off of their popularity from A Bim Bam, My Brother and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this whole world. So the streaming, Twitch and streaming and podcast actual play movement is absolutely a huge thing. Something else that I think we're going to see is a further development of kind of narrative mechanic design with a lot of fluency, where I think we may see a movement back through. So in Forge Theory, there was like gamism, narrativism, and simulationism. And there were certain games that are like, oh, this is simulating a very specific thing. I think we're likely to see some of the storytelling and mechanical design tools that have been developed in the 2010s applying to a whole new set of simulationist style play. And that some of those games already have that built in. Band of Blades has a fairly strongly defined premise. Mm-hmm. You are the last members of the Legion fleeing after this specific failure to this specific place. Here are our touchstones. This game lets you play this thing. Simulationism, for me, is kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum along this axis from something like GURPS or even Fate Core.
Sure.
And Fate Core has designed itself to be able to slot in these other things, but the mechanics themselves do not say, we are mechanics that suggest blah. We are not mechanics that suggest the creeping fear of zombie apocalypse. Whereas in other games, the mechanics are designed to specifically invoke tone or genre in a specific way. And I think I would expect us to see a new wave of games that are drilling down even more so than something like the Power by the Apocalypse type of games, though some of them are more simulationist than others. So that's something else that I think is likely based on what I'm seeing and that a mechanical and design developments from the past few years.
Yeah. The game Dread popped into my head as far as mechanics where you're pulling Jenga pieces that represent whether or not you succeed at something. And if you're not familiar with Dread, this is how it works. You have to pull a piece from a Jenga tower. And if the tower falls, your character dies. And so you can imagine it's a horror game. So it is a mechanic that works with the narrative to implement that horror creep as the game goes on. It's a brilliant move to bring around another style of game. I don't see that coming forward in your next edition of D&D, but it made me think of that as a narrative mechanic.
Yeah, and I think that touches on something else that I would like to see, but I'm not going to necessarily hold my breath, is I would like to see more active and possibly like commercially aggressive attempts to create smooth off-roads from D&D to story games.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Where we've had this huge fifth edition resurgence, you know, 3.5, 3.75, 3.x with Pathfinder, open gaming license, really widened the aperture so that like, oh, cool, big resurgence of D&D. And then people got into this kind of D&D plus space, into like the D&D OGL space.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that got sucked up by Pathfinder. And then we have fifth edition and it's had its own resurgence boom and it's assisted by stuff like Critical Role and the Adventure Zone, but also D&D Beyond, Twitch, Roll20. And from the data that we have, most of that boom is still in the D&D space.
Right.
And I think as D&D becomes a lifestyle, there is room for more games to come in and be like, you can D&D, but like this.
And like this.
And that flourish is, here's a game, here's a set of rules, and its genre is still D&D, and you just peel the words D&D off so you don't get sued, and underneath it says fantasy adventure.
Sure.
Because D&D is in the process of Xeroxing fantasy adventure as a genre, if it hasn't already, in terms of turning their individual name into the brand for the whole thing.
I hadn't seen that. That's a really good point.
And there are already games that try to do this. Dungeon World used the Powered by the Apocalypse game, the Powered by the Apocalypse style. But Dungeon World, at least the base version, is very much about recapturing some of the flavor of old school Renaissance, like basic to first edition to Redbox, like that era of D&D, even before my time, especially exemplified in the art, but also in the mechanics, like it's the thief class instead of the rogue class and stuff like that. And I definitely see space for a new round of games that are consciously going after that interstice. People who like D&D as a genre or as a lifestyle, but are interested in exploring other ways of doing D&D without only ever using fifth edition.
Right, right. Okay. Well, we are almost out of time. So I'm gonna wrap this up. I want to, you are my first contestant in my new game called Would You Rather, the Natural Geekery Edition. I've been collecting questions. I asked you earlier off mic, do you have a D20 on you? You do. So if you would do me the favor of rolling a D20, and I will give you your question from this list that I have.
Okay. Do you want the clackety clackety on the mic?
Sure. Make the clackety clackety if you want.
Okay. We'll see if this picks up.
Oh, that picks up.
All right, that's a 20.
You got a 20.
I did,
my first contestant, and I got a 20. Okay, all right, here we go. Would you rather have 30 butterflies instantly appear every time you sneeze, or one grumpy pixie dragon appear every time you cough? Dun, 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 dun.
Grumpiness almost automatically leans me toward the butterflies. The trick there is going to be like, sneezing in the winter. I tend to sneeze in like 2, 3, or 4 sneeze chunks, and that becomes a really gigantic number of butterflies.
Which would, I mean, poor butterflies, right?
Right, because then it's like the whole rigmarole. I would need to get a butterfly net, and then this leads to me in slippers trying to usher butterflies out into the winter, and like, it's winter. They should be hybrid. Like, they should not be out in the world.
Right. Right.
So maybe I might be better off going pixie dragon and applying everything that I've learned being hippie adjacent in Bloomington, how to appease grumpy fairies.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to turn the other way and go grumpy pixie dragon.
Okay. Grumpy pixie dragon. All right. Let it be noted. Thank you so much. That was good. Thanks so much for playing. You were the first contestant on the Natural Geekery version of Would You Rather. Fun stuff. Thank you, Mike. This has been wonderful.
We could easily go on for many more hours. But...
Well, and you know, I know that I have a feeling this isn't going to be your only time on this show. So we'll save the rest for the future. Where can folks find you out on the big bad interwebs?
Sure thing. Probably the best place to find me as a baseline is my website, which is michaelrunderwood.com. That's the letter R rather than R like a pirate. I'm on Twitter at MikeRUnderwood. And I have a Patreon with essays about the craft and business of publishing, as well as some musings about gaming and other recommendations. So if you liked the Amazon rant or the way that I talked about publishing, then definitely check out the Patreon if that's a world that you want to move into.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Hopefully we'll get you on here again here soon. And have a great evening. Thanks for coming along and being a natural geek with me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Look forward to keep on listening.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Once again, I want to thank Michael R. Underwood for being on the show and being in that interview. That was a deep dive down into the world of publishing and as well as gaming, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you guys did too. You can find all of Mike's links that were mentioned in the interview down in the show notes. I want to highly recommend his Patreon. It is a small price to pay for a body of knowledge and information that he can help you with, and knowledge that you can gain if you're interested in that sort of thing. And just in general, give him a look. He is a great guy, and I can't wait to have him on the show again really, really soon. We'll see what we can do about that. That's going to be it for me today. I'm going to go get a nice hot lemon tea for my throat, and hopefully next week I won't be as froggy in your earbuds. I just want to say thank you for listening. Thanks for being part of this Natural Geekery community. I could not do it without you, and I hope you are still enjoying this show as much as I am. If you have any questions, comments, or requests, you can find me on Twitter at Coyote Guy or at Natural Geekery. You can also just email me at naturalgeekery@gmail.com. And as I close, I want to say, remember, you're needed out here. Your story may inspire someone else. It may help someone. Live your life as best as you can. Make a plan, roll some dice, and tell your story. Until next time, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.